It's having a design to pour your creativity and intention and autonomy into as a teacher. You know, to have a framework, some kind of boundary, some kind of thing to work in that makes all of our choices intentional in designing. That way I can just pour my creativity and my autonomy into it as a teacher, but then I also see the learning happening on the other side. And all of it's about these intentional instructional choices we make before we ever step into the classroom. If we don't make these choices, then we're going to go in there and teach and hope that learning happens. And it might, you know, you'll get some because, you know, it happens. I want to be able to know without a shadow of a doubt that learning at high levels happened before I ever walked in the room. And at the same time, it'd be nice to make some of these gains that we've lost over these years. And so that's why design is so important.
Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path. Well, welcome everybody to The Peg Doesn't Fit. Today we've got Jason Kennedy on the show with us today. He is an author and an otherwise all-around amazing gentleman. And we're going to dive right into this. So, Jason, we're going to actually kind of let you get us started here. But tell us about what you kind of told me this off camera, but what brought you to where you are today?
Right. This is my, we're about to wrap up my 23rd year in education. I went through about my first year and a quarter of college as a medical. You know, one spring break I spent, instead of going to the beach like everybody else, I went to a local hospital. We had a family friend who was an anesthesiologist, and I just basically stood next to him and watched a bunch of surgeries, you know, for a week. And so I just looked around the room and I'm like, I'm gonna be bored to death. And so I went and picked the polar opposite of that and went into education. So, I've always loved reading literature and all that good stuff. And so secondary English education major, I went, and, the rest is history.
That's fantastic. 'Cause we got three of them in this room right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, all the way across.
No wonder I like you guys.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just wanted
go ahead.
Know how awesome you are.
Now that Eric cut us off, were you done sharing where you are today?
Like I was telling you earlier, Ryan, I'm sure that a lot of us have had the same experience, especially, you know, middle grades and secondary majors. It's, you know, we just content all through college. Mm-hmm. And you left college and you didn't know anything about learning.
Yeah,
and so, like I said before, we might have taken educational psychology and you might have learned your Maslow and your, you know, Bloom and your Piaget and your Dewey and some other, you know, stuff. But, you know, you didn't know how to translate that into the classroom. Mm-hmm. And you really didn't know what learning was. And so you just went in there and you taught like you were taught.
Right.
And hopefully you tried to make it a little bit more entertaining. Mm-hmm. But it took me about 15 years until, you know, I realized that, man, I've been doing the job all wrong. The job is learning. And so, you know, we just got to take what we've learned in the last, like I said, about 2009, 2010-ish, we've got all this educational research that's been poured into education that we've never had before. And we just got to start using it for what the job's really about. And that's, you know, designing learning for our learners.
Yeah, I tell you what, I'm super excited about this episode because I've been kind of heading down this rabbit hole ever since I read John Hattie's Visible Learning.
Oh yeah.
Just in terms of how much sense it makes, no matter how good of a teacher you are, it doesn't really matter if the students aren't learning what you're teaching.
Exactly.
So, you know, before we really dig into this, I am curious what your favorite, I guess it's not called a Hattie effect size. I don't know. That's what he measures them. It's a teaching influence or whatever. What's your favorite one of John Hattie? And we'll see if we align there.
I picked this one just because it's got a whole bunch of other stuff kind of wrapped up in it in my mind. And it's student reported grades.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's the third highest,
mm-hmm.
you know, right behind teacher reported grades and collective teacher advocacy. We're looking at student reported grades. And what that means is, you know, people are like, what in the world? how's that going to help me design learning in the classroom? Well, you know, student reported grades means that students are so well versed in, you know, the learning process in class that they know that they've been exposed to learning goals and learning intentions and learning targets. They know what the targets are. They know that there's a success criteria that they self-assess by. They know what feedback and how it's used. And so when a student reported grades effect size and it's 1.33, you know, you're talking, you know, 3+ years, it's got all that other stuff built into it. Teacher clarity, success criteria, learning intentions and targets. It's got all that other gooey good stuff that we know that works built into it. So it's kind of a little catch-all for some other things I'm a big fan of. So
yeah,
if I had to pick one, that would probably be it, because whose learning is it after all? It's theirs.
Right.
And so they should be the ones reporting their grades.
Yeah.
You know, they should be the one, you know, assessing their learning. They should be the ones moving themselves upward. And all of that requires design on our part. You know, we went in there and taught these past 150 years, just hoping it happens. And what we need to do is step back and design it so that it does with intention and impact.
No, that's a great answer. Actually, I was just going to go with teacher clarity, just in terms of on a basic level, how important is it for your kids to know what they're learning? And I loved your example in your book, and I guess we didn't get you a chance to introduce that. I'll give you a second after this, but you said you walked into that classroom, and I don't know if it was an ELA classroom, if it was an art classroom or something, but it had something to do with whales. Maybe they were reading a story about whales, you know, and you're like, what are you learning? And the kid said, well, I'm learning about whales.
Right.
And you're like, well, I don't think that there's anything about whales in the standards, right. You know, but that's how it goes. And it's the same thing. When I go into a class, it might be art, you know, and they might be drawing a self-portrait, and they're like, I'm learning how to draw myself. I'm like, no, you're not. You're learning about lines and shades and all that stuff. So that was mine, is teacher clarity. And I think that ties in pretty good with what we're getting ready to talk about. What about you, Ryan?
I would actually align with Jason, because I get into the rabbit hole I go down with that is the gamification element that it could bring about. Like my son, he's finished this video game, finished it, yet there are so many elements that he sees for like incomplete status elements. Like, well, I'm not quite done with this part of the game, so though I've beaten it, I want to do this. But all of it is visual. And so he is driven to continue to do that, even though he's technically finished. And I think that when we apply that to the classroom, or we think about adults, how we check our phone to see how many hours of sleep we got on a certain app, or how many steps we got for the last while. When we think about that in terms of how do we grade ourselves, how do we think we're doing, what are we aware of, that's a huge motivating factor. And so when a kid is giving the grade, they're incentivized to say, you know what, here's where I think I'm at. But then they are also very aware of, I'm in control of this and I want to do better. Way more so than, well, I'm just waiting to see what the teacher gives me. Right. We'll hope for the best.
Yeah, and I would argue that you have to have teacher clarity built in to have student reported grades working in the first place.
And right. So that top, like you said, that top chunk are so intertwined of all the Hattie elements, or whatever you want to call them, that it's tough to separate them out.
Well, let's go before we move on any more questions. Why don't we give you an opportunity? Because now I don't believe your book is published yet. It's coming out. You want to tell us the name of your book, when it's coming out, and then the rest of our episode is definitely going to tie into digging into a little bit about what you wrote about.
Gotcha. Well, you know, it started off with just me putting up a website called Let's Quit Teaching and writing some thoughts on there. And then that kind of grew into about a chapter or two that, you know, one of them was one of the ones I sent you guys. And, you know, I really sent this thing piecemeal to a publisher, and they said, well, when can you have it done? And so I was like, okay, you know, this was in August of last year. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I'm going to give myself till Christmas. Day after Thanksgiving, I submitted it to them. And so Right now, I've submitted the final proofs. You know, it's been available for pre-order on Amazon for a while. And, you know, hopefully we're getting it out in the hands in April. You know, so just waiting on the production part of it. But, you know, it's an exciting journey. The original title is Let's Quit Teaching and Start Designing Learning. And, you know, we had to tweak that a little bit just in the climate we're in with, you know, teachers wanting to leave the profession. So we decided Let's Stop Teaching was maybe a better title. So, but regardless, we've got the same sentiment. You know, we've been doing this teaching thing for really about 200 years, the same way. And we know now more than ever about learning and what it takes, you know, to induce it in our students. And so we got to use that to change what we do, especially, you know, post COVID, where we, you know, we didn't have learning loss. Students didn't lose the ability to learn how to, you know, they didn't lose the ability to read or add or subtract. We didn't have learning loss. We had missed out learning or missed learning opportunities. And so, you know, we got to make up for that.
Yep.
And so effect sizes work. They come to me in you know, a normal year and they attend normally, then they're going to grow 1 year. So, but not of our kids are coming to us in the same spot. We got some kids coming us way back here. Yeah. And so that's why we got to build in all this, you know, these impactful design qualities into every day and every lesson to just, you know, get kids, you know, back on board with where they need to be in learning. So that's mainly what it's about. If I had to sum it up, it'd be a nice blueprint and jumpstart for a newbie teacher who's fresh out of college, who like me didn't learn anything about learning, or it might be a veteran who's like, you know what, light bulb, I've been teaching all these years and maybe I need to turn this thing around, or some leaders, you know, because in my mind, if you're a leader in a building and you're not, you know, fluent in the practice, then you're practicing professional negligence, in my opinion, you know, because your number one job as a leader is to promote student learning. Mm-hmm. And your second job is to support your staff. Those are two questions on my desk. And so if I did those two things that day at work, then I've done my job.
So I'm thinking about this as an admin, principal of a building. I would assume that you might propose the same thing, that my job is to promote teacher learning. And could I go about it the same way that you propose you would promote student learning? I'm asking for a friend.
Absolutely, because I mean, learning is the job. Mm-hmm. Learning, inducing in our students, I'm trying to get away from students, inducing in our learners, is our job. And we have to be learners ourselves. I mean, think about all the other professions like doctors and lawyers and everything. They're constantly having to learn, constantly having to update. And so if we want to be treated like the profession that we are, we have to do the same. And I know that, you know, teachers, hardest working profession there is that I can, you know, imagine. Mm-hmm. So that's why number two, the second question is so important. What did I do today to support my staff? And so that's why, you know, because if you're supporting your staff, you're supporting your learners, because they're the one providing learning.
Yeah, I like it. You've started to allude to this. So we'll get a little more detail here. Why do teachers need to stop teaching and start designing learning? And describe the difference a little bit.
Right. You know, it all comes down to the choices we make after we decide who's coming to our room. Mm-hmm. You know, for so many years, we've had students come to our room, and mainly what we teach them is content and compliance. Mm-hmm. You know, I wager if you went around to your kids in your halls and said, hey, what's a good student? You know, they'll say, well, it's a good student. You know, what does a good student do? Well, they raise their hand. They do their work.
Yeah.
They're quiet in class. You know, a lot of compliance stuff.
Right.
And content. And I can say this because I've been, you know, teaching middle school and high school. We are the chief of sinners, you know, when it comes to content laying on kids. So, you know, we've been really heavy content and compliance with students. So what we got to think about is, okay, well, I got learners coming to my room. if I want learning to happen in my learners, I got a lot of different choices I need to make other than what am I going to teach today? You know, I would argue the very first thing you got to do is, okay, how am I going to build the positive relationships with my learners in my room? You know, because I'll just go ahead and tell you, everything else is going to be that much harder if you don't. Positive relationships, key to building, because then, I mean, think about positive student-teacher relationships. Well, on top of that, teacher credibility, effect mm-hmm. size, 0.47, I think. Well, you lose that if they don't trust you. You lose that. 0.90, teacher credibility. And then on top of that, you build in teacher clarity. And on top of that, you build in, you know, all the other things. And so it all starts with relationships. But I love my learners who come to my room. And then I got to design learning for these learners. And that's a little bit more, you know, if there was anything I could say that would describe teaching versus learning, one is forward and one is backwards, you know, and designing learning is backwards, where teaching content is basically forward. And it makes the choices you make intentional when you know your impact.
You know, I'm glad you said that, that designing learning is backwards, because we've talked about this before on the podcast, but the whole planning with the end in mind, to me, seems to be a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you figure out, you look at your mountain of standards, you know, this big binder you have with all these standards, and you're flipping through, you say, okay, I'm going to teach that. But out of that, what is it that I want the students to learn?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's what my focus is. So once I figure out what it is I want them to learn out of that standard, well, then I can go back and plan activities to help guide them to what I want them to know. And right. I mean, it sounds like a no-brainer, but it's just more natural just to kind of show up and teach, you know, because it's easier too. You know, you can
much easier.
You can make your lesson plans in your head on the way to work, right?
Especially since, you know, you've been drilled into content your whole college career. So, you know, I can't tell you how many Shakespeare courses I had as a secondary English major.
Right.
So I could quote you all sorts of stuff, and I could get up there and wing it with the best of them. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking at that nice, compliant kid who always does his work over there, and I have to ask myself, okay, is he learning anything?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's dive into this a little bit more, because in terms of that backwards by design, planning with the end in mind, I mean, you have to have a learning target, right?
Right.
So there's nobody listening to this episode right now that doesn't know what a learning target is. I mean, we've all had that one PD like in August about what a learning target is, and then in April we get reminded about that one PD we had back in August. Right. So I don't know if the attention professionally is given to the importance of that, because I think a lot of teachers look at that as like, oh, it's just one more thing I have to do, but it really isn't. It should be everything you do surrounds about that. So sometime in life, and I think you brought it up earlier with this light bulb, but sometimes in life, no matter how many times we've read, we've heard, we've listened, you know, because I can lead professional development and I see all the heads in the audience nodding. Yeah, this is a great idea. This is a great idea. But if we don't like go use it immediately, by the time next week rolls around, it's like it never happened. So here's your chance to be somebody's light bulb. What is a learning target and why is it so essential to have? I mean, what can you say to our listeners that will finally, or not finally, but just make that click of why that's so important? And it's not just an extra thing you have to do to check off an observation box.
Right. Well, unfortunately, I can, you know, just like you and I maybe have talked about it, you know, to all these other professionals, we can say it all day long, but until they actually put in the work into them, they're not going to get that light bulb that we want them to get. But I'll give you a light bulb. 4 years ago, I was asked to come to a school to help, you know, turn their instruction around. And the first thing we did was, okay, let's go look at our standards and get some learning targets planned out. And, you know, you might have one standard, but embedded in that standard might be five or six learning targets. You know, because the standards are so broad. Mm-hmm. And so what we have to decide is, okay, what is the standard asking us? You know, we probably all have deconstructed standards, circle the nouns, underline the verbs. You know, that's what they need to know. This is what they need to do. We put that in student-friendly language. We, you know, and then we take all these targets, we sequence them, we decide when we're going to assess, all that good stuff. We find out what, you know, we deem what is a must have and a may help, you know, because we're not going to cover them all. You know, and it's not about covering the standards, right? It's about students discovering the learning. And so, you know, we know the Common Core is going to take about 22 years to get through all the Common Core standards. Well, we know we don't have students quite that long. So learning targets, they focus the learning of the day. And if, you know, it's real easy for me to throw a standard up on the board and leave it up there for a week, but this learning target, it's whatever we're doing from the time you enter to the time you leave. And me personally, I've never been one to want a learning target to continue into day two. And here's why. I want the kids to have it all nice, wrapped up, summarized at the end, so I know where we need to go tomorrow. And I'll give you an example. You know, I might have a learning target. I can solve, you know, two-step equations. I'm going to not get to that in one class period, in a 45-minute class period, if that's what I have. So today, we're not doing that. We're just going to say, I can isolate the variable in a two-step equation. And that's what we're going to work on today. That's what we're going to make sure that this is our focus for today. All we want to do is basically be able to isolate the variable before we walk out of the room. And that's, you know, the importance of learning target. Because, well, I gave my example, my staff before. Let's say I take everybody outside and we're going to have a foot race, and I line you up all by the flagpole in the front of the school. And I say, on your mark, get set, go, and I fire a pistol, and everybody's just standing there looking at each other because I never told you where the finish line was. Mm-hmm. Learning targets are the finish line before our students leave out of the room. We should be talking about it in the opening, in the instruction, in the work session, in the closing. It is what everything revolves around. And students have to know that just as much as you do, because it is that first question of that teacher clarity. What am I learning?
So what do I do if we get to the end of the class and 50% of the kids know it, 50% don't, or whatever? Do you say, I still could move that to the next day, but it's still about completion within a class period? Or I don't know where I go with this, but I think about the whole reteaching element.
Yeah, sure. You know, part of our closing needs to be, okay, summarizing our progress, but also praising our progress. We don't do that enough either. Mm-hmm. But we find out, okay, here's how far we got today, gang. Here's where we need to be. What tripped us up today? You know, what were some of the misconceptions? What were some of the misunderstandings that got in the way? You know, were some of the tools that we talked through and provided while you were in the work session, where did they fall short? What got you stuck? And so we can talk about that and get that ready for tomorrow. And it might be just a quick fix. Depends on what we're talking about. Or it might be tomorrow, you know, we might be taking this learning target a step further. And so when I release, you know, my learners in a work session, they have a success criteria to follow. Those that are looking at what a level one is, no, I cannot, yada, yada, yet. Those are the ones that are probably didn't get the first part of it yesterday. Guess who I'm small grouping with?
Yeah.
Those level ones. Because, you know, the level, I won't say level kids. I don't like level kids. Where they're at in their learning is level one. Where they're at learning level two, they have a tool to use to move themselves up to a level three. Mm-hmm. So they don't need, hey, Mr. K, you know, I'm small group with a group of five. I get them on something, I go back around and check, you know, hey, where are you guys at? You know, you're using a success criteria. You're measuring your own learning. Where are you at? Where you need to be? You know, we'll talk about that in the feedback in a minute, I'm sure.
Yeah. So a couple of things you brought up, and I can't find the actual, I got my hattie up, but I can't find it where I know that it's high. Success criteria. What's that look like? Like, is that a rubric or, you know, do the kid, I know that we talked to Chad Lang last week, and he talked a lot about performance scales.
Right.
You know, and I know not every district or not every teacher is at that level to have a performance scale designed to measure their learning. But what would success criteria look like for somebody that's just wanting to start this?
So performance scales, slash proficiency standards, whatever you want to call them, I find that those are more for the adults. And a success criteria is more for the learner in the room. So let's say I have my learning target for the day is I can identify and classify examples of figurative language. Mm-hmm. So what does quality evidence of that look like for the task I've designed for you today? Let's say the task was you're reading something, you're finding the figurative language, and you're going to classify it. So that's meeting the standard. That's a level three for today's learning. I take that a step back, level two. Yes, I can identify that this is figurative language, but I'm having trouble classifying it. Mm-hmm. So that's where I build in a tool for those kids who are at a two in their learning and when they want to move to a three. So one of the things I designed was I'll design a flow chart that can just simple yes or no questions. Mm-hmm. Does it have like or as? I mean, just flow chart. That's one of the easiest ones you can make. Level one, again, no, I can't pick out any figurative language. Well, guess who's small grouping with me. Mm-hmm. And then if I want to take a step up, level four, if I want to move to a level four in my learning, well, I can, you know, identify and classify the figurative language, and I can even tell you why the author chose this figurative language example to use. Mm-hmm. You know, what effect does it have on the text? So I tend to use a lot of one through fours, but you can also use a single point, put the three in the middle and say, here's what I need, here's what I got already. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a rubric, and you could call it a rubric, but the more tangible physical characteristics you can put in a success criteria that kids can look at and say, you know what, my evidence that I've produced today in my learning task, it has these qualities, then they can prove to themselves that they have learned it. Mm-hmm. And that's question number three in teacher clarity. You know, how do I know I've learned it? And, you know, making it, take it a step farther and have your students co-create these with you on the fly.
Yeah.
You want to see some powerful learning happen, do that. Say, okay, today you guys are supposed to be able to identify and classify figurative language. So, you know, if we're going to read this text, you know, what do you think learning looks like? How are you going to show me that you have learned how to do that today? You know, what is quality work going to look like? What's quality evidence that can prove to you and to me and anybody else in the room that you know how to identify and classify and make it up on the fly with kids, and you will see them get engaged. And you also, you know, it's a beautiful thing because then they can't complain about, you know, about anything because they made it up. They made the criteria.
Right.
I didn't do this, guys. You came up with this. So
yeah. And students are often harder on themselves than.
Absolutely.
So they're going to come up. Sometimes as a teacher, you might have to say, okay, that's a great lofty goal, but let's bring it down just a notch.
Sure.
Well, I did find that effect size for success criteria, and it's 0.88. So it's actually higher than teacher clarity.
Hmm. And teacher clarity has been bumped up. It's 0.84 now.
Okay.
But you can't really have teacher clarity without success criteria, the how do I know I've learned it part. So, you know, and you can't have a what am I learning if you don't have a learning target. So if you just build in, like I've been saying, build in some of these design qualities into what we do every day. And it's not like these things are a magic wand. Oh, I use the success criteria today, so they're going to go 2 years.
Right.
You know, I've got to do this often.
Yeah.
I got to do it well, mm-hmm. and I've got to do it over the long term.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this, and I know this is a popular statement, one that I asked at least our last two guests. What's your stance on whether that learning target should be posted? Because, and I'll give you some background on that. Well, you already know. I mean, when you ask teachers to post their learning target, again, they see it as a box they have to check off that when a administrator walks in to provide an evaluation or just a simple pop in or a walkthrough, that's the first thing the administrator is going to look for. So I want to kind of give you my take on it after I get yours, but I'm curious what your stance is on that.
Gotcha. So if we're really using it like we need to use it, for example, you know, whatever activating strategy I've got going on first thing when you guys walk in, might be a sort. Let's stick with this figurative language stuff. I might have 12 different slips of paper and they're, you know, a bunch of different figurative language examples. And I tell everybody, hey, sort these into groups. I'm not going to tell you how. I'm not going to tell you what they are. Just sort them into groups. And then they reach consensus in their groups, and I'm like, okay, well, today, you know, everything on your table is an example of figurative language. And so, you know, what we have to figure out, what we got to learn today is, you know, how to identify these and how to classify these before we can ever figure out maybe why the author chose a certain one. So let's dive into that day. So I should be referring to the learning target in the opening. I should definitely be referring to it in the instruction, mm-hmm. you know, my instruction to them. And the instruction, I call it the gist. Our job in the instruction is to give them the guided information, skills, and tools. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a task coming up that I've designed for them in the work session, which should be about half of the class period is their work session. So I've got something coming up that I got to prepare them for. And so I got to give them the guided, which means me facilitating the information, whether that's text, facts, notes, whatever kind of information they need. Skills, what do I need to model? What processes do they need to be able to understand to be able to put into action, whatever? And then what tools they need to be introduced to their success criteria? They need to be able to access tools to escape their misunderstandings. They need to know where, hey, I got this. Where, how can I accelerate myself? And so I provide the gist around that learning target. Work sessions, all about the learning target. They're producing evidence that shows that they have met the learning target. And then in closing, we're summarizing our process, you know, our progress toward the learning target. We're praising our progress. We're going back and addressing any misconceptions about the learning target that we might have and how it's going to bleed over into our next day's worth learning. So if we're referring to it like we should and using it as a tool throughout the whole lesson, that's how you get people to realize that, you know, I might need this up the whole class period.
And that's how I would have described it. Minus the gist. I love that strategy or that process of thinking. But if nothing else, because I'm going to go back to your example about the two steps equations, and I'm not a math guy, but you said, okay, we're not going to do the whole two step equation today. We're going to focus on isolating the variable, right?
Right.
Well, as a math teacher, you know, that's on its most basic level. And just by having that up there, because a kid might suck you into the next step and you're like, wait a second. I get where you're going, but check it out. And then you actually point to the board and look, today, all we're focusing on is isolating that variable. I like how you're thinking, and I feel really good that tomorrow you're going to be getting this like really well, but let's stay focused on today's learning objective. And let's just focus on isolating that variable. And we'll get to the actual second step tomorrow.
Right.
If nothing else, it serves as a reminder to keep you on track.
Yeah. And absolutely. And you, if you got that kid ready to run, well, guess what? If you got that success criteria and he's already met level, you know, a level three worth of learning, what can I put for these kids to, you know, cause we're killing ourselves remediating, but we don't think about, you know, kids already know 40 to 60% of what we're teaching them.
Right.
Graham Nuthall, have you ever read The Hidden Lives of Learners? 40 to 60%, they already know. And so it's so important where we got to accelerate some of this stuff, you know.
Well, we got to create those light bulbs for them.
Exactly.
Because they do know a lot of information, but we have to physically connect those dots. That's the power of prior experiences and prior knowledge, right? Because we want to get them to be able to apply what we're learning. And the way we can get them to apply it is by recognizing how in their life they already have used it. And they don't even know. So we have to physically connect those dots for them to help them make the connections. And then at some point in their life, it's all going to click and they're going to be able to make their own connections, but we have to help them along the way.
Sure. And we got to design opportunities for that to happen, because learning at its core is taking new information and connecting it to old knowledge. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how we learn. And so we got to make that happen in the classroom. It's in the book. Don't worry.
Perfect. It's written down for us. Well, I'm wondering about, you're describing kind of a classroom situation. So if you're just thinking about designing an engaging task,
right?
What does that look like? What are the necessary components of that?
All right. So there's several pieces we got to worry about, you know, when we're talking about, you know, engaging tasks. So first, this task, whatever we design, has to be able to be centered on the target, and centered on the target at a high level. You know, we're not here to dumb things down. Mm-hmm. We're here for every single student to meet this target. You know, we start with the target and we raise kids up to it. We don't lower the target down. You know, just doesn't matter who's in the room. You know, all learners are all learners, and they're coming to us to learn. You know, they might have some different backgrounds coming to us. They might have some, you know, I made this analogy in a piece of writing one time. You know, kids come to us lined up in a vertical, you know, a vertical line outside of our door. And if you wanted to make that analogy, they're lined up at learning to learning in a vertical line. These kids in the front, they're really close to learning. Mm-hmm. They had extra resources at home. They had parents who read to them. They had whatever kind of advantage you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Kids in the back of the line, they're much farther away from this learning. So our job as educators is to bring these learners into the room and turn that vertical line into horizontal line. So everybody's lined up equal distance from learning. Mm-hmm. And some of that is about scaffolding and everything else. So first of all, we don't lower the target. Mm-hmm. The target's the target. We raise kids up to it. Mm-hmm. So engaging task first got to be target driven. Second, you need to build in engagement. And if you've never read 17,000 class visits can't be wrong. Classroom visits can't be wrong.
Is this one in your book too?
Well, I mentioned the book, but it's another book. It's Antonelli and Garver. They conducted, you know, obviously 17,000 classroom visits. And what they found was 8 different qualities that result in engagement. Teacher clarity was one of them. Safety was one of them. Novelty, you know, a lot of different ones. There's 8 of them. And if you have these 8 qualities, you'll have an engaging task. And so that might overwhelm some people. 8 qualities mm-hmm. to put in a task. But here's the beautiful part. You only need 3, they found, to have 87% sustained engagement. Mm-hmm. So hear me out. If I'm a teacher who's built in trust in my and built that positive relationship, they feel safe. There's one in my pocket. Okay. If I practice teacher clarity every day with learning targets and success criteria, I got 2 in my pocket. So mm-hmm. now I only have to have a 3rd one. Mm-hmm. Novelty, audience, the rest are in the book, but really go check out 17,000 Class Visits Can't Be Wrong by Antonelli and Garver. They list the rest. So get those 3. You got 87% sustained engagement in a task. And the last quality that you probably need to have an engaging task is this task needs to result in evidence of learning that kids can look at and you can look at, and anybody else who walks in the room can look at and say, you know what, this learner has proven to everybody that they can whatever learning target is. So learning target based, hold it high, and design an engagement and results in evidence of learning.
Wow. That is, again, you know, when you just sit back and talk about this stuff, I mean, it seems simple, right? I mean, here's 8 things. Do 3 of them and 83% of your class is going to be engaged, or 86, mm-hmm. You know, and it's just putting that little extra thought into it and designing, as you say. Let's talk about some feedback, though. So obviously students need to know if what they're doing is right. You know, talk to us about why feedback is so important and then maybe some ways that you go around doing that.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of our feedback, I'll say a lot of teaching feedback is, okay, this is right, or, oh, this is wrong. Good job, or go fix it. Right. That's not doing a kid anything. For feedback to really stick and to work, you got to have those teacher clarity pieces. You got to have a learning target, and you got to have success criteria for feedback to actually mean something. Here's why. Yeah. Here's your goal for the day, learner. We've already talked about it. You know where it is. You know where the finish line is. Where are you right now? You know, where are you at? You know, are you here? Are you here? You know, where are you at based on the success criteria? Now I can provide you feedback. You know where you got to get to. You know that you're here. Well, here's some suggestions. Here how I can help you get from here to the next step. Mm-hmm. That's feedback. You know, you have to have a goal. You have to have what success looks like for them to reference. And then your job is to provide that feedback. Now, you got to have it acted upon. Otherwise, feedback won't work at all. And so you got to have students be able to engage in whatever feedback you're giving them and be clear about it. you know, intentional about it. And that's where that success criteria comes in. That's where, you know, building in those tools for them to escape their misunderstandings, or building the tools to accelerate them, you know, on a pathway to take it, you know, their learning to the next level, you know, providing those tools, you know, and telling them how to get there. Because feedback, you know, teachers are killing themselves in a class. I had classes of 32 when I taught. And so you have that goal and that learning target, and you have a success criteria to reference. Three quarters of your class, about 60, you know, two thirds of your class, they're going to be all in. They're gone. I got my five or six that really need my small, you know, group intention just to get them on track. And then I got some kids that need to be accelerated. I got to be able to provide feedback for all of them. And so that's when I have to walk in with these tools ready. Otherwise, I'm just going to be answering 32 hands all the time.
Talk to us real quick about those escape tools, because I love that, and I'm not sure everybody quite got that.
Sure. Well, you know, part of it is experience with whatever subject you're teaching. Part of it is looking at past student work. Mm-hmm. And some of it's just, you know, sometimes it's on the fly. But, for example, I had a chemistry teacher one time, and I was trying to help him out, and I was like, look, put an anchor chart up on the board. You know, even have it student made. Put it up on the wall over here. And whenever a kid gets stuck, you point them to that resource.
Awesome.
And he's like, Kennedy, that'll never work. You know, these kids and that kid and whatever. And I say, just try it. He came back to me a week later. He's like, I'll never do anything else again. Mm-hmm. And that's just a poster, you know. I'll just go ahead and tell you, the four walls in your room are the greatest learning, you know, real estate you got. Use it.
Yep.
But other than that, we got so much technology now. I mean, you got Flipgrid and all these other places where kids can upload videos of, you know, teaching other kids. And so if you've got tools that they know where and how to access before you get into that work session to escape any misunderstanding they might have without having to do, you know, raise your hand and come find me. You know, we keep them learning the whole class period. We keep them engaged. We, you know, collaboration, turn and talk. I mean, there's so many tools you can build in, you know, but again, you know, my thing is, I'm like, teachers, give me all your planning time back. Give me all your planning time, and I will give you all of your classroom time back, because you will be facilitating and they will be doing the heavy lifting of learning. Typically, we got kids, you know, doing cartwheels down the hallway when they leave us, and we're dragging.
Right.
I want to flip that.
Yeah.
We need to flip it, and they need to be doing the heavy lifting and learning. But that requires, I'm sorry, all of our planning time, and if, you know, takes your PLCs getting together, looking at student work, designing tools together, collaborating, you know, so, you know, just making it possible for the students to take on learning, because remember, it's theirs after all. That's what we have to, you know, spend all our prep time on.
Yeah, that was awesome. Well, listen, Jason, we run into this problem with all of our guests, because we just want to keep talking forever, but nobody wants to keep listening, and we all have things to do. I mean, it's Valentine's Day, right?
Sure.
We gotta go on dates. So let's wrap it up with this. We talked about a lot of really good stuff in this episode, and I mean, those anchored, just a lot of good stuff. But if you could just leave us with one, I don't know, you want to summarize it or something we didn't get a chance to talk about, but maybe, you know, just the most important thing that you want someone to come out of this episode with, and we'll just let you give you the floor.
Well, again, it's just about, it's having a design to pour your creativity and intention and autonomy into as a teacher. You know, I hated any constraints on my part as a teacher in the classroom. You know, I did not want to read Romeo and Juliet. I did not want to read all the other things that were in my parents' textbooks when they were in school. I'm sure not, you know, subjecting my ninth graders to it. We read Stephen King and all these other things that I liked reading. And guess what? They discovered that they liked reading, you know, just because we're not reading the same old stories, you know. Yes, I'm an English major, and yeah, I got those favorite stories, but they're not necessarily a ninth grader's favorite story in 2023, like the Telltale Heart or, you know, the Monkey's Paw or anything else like that. Mm-hmm. So you know, classics. We've got to have a framework, you know, some kind of boundary, some kind of thing to work in that makes all of our choices intentional in designing. That way I can just pour my creativity and my autonomy into it as a teacher, but then I also see the learning happening on the other side, you know, and all of it's about these intentional instructional choices we make before we ever step into the classroom. You know, if we don't make these choices, then we're going to go in there and teach and hope that learning happens. And it might, you know, you'll get some because, you know, it happens, but I want to be able to know without a shadow of a doubt that learning at high levels happened before I ever walked in the room. And at the same time, it'd be nice to make some of these gains that we've lost over these years. And so that's why design is so important, because if I know all these effect sizes of all these things that learning, you know, that research says works in learning, I need to pack as much into it, you know, into my, what I do in the classroom as possible, you know, and make that a practice. That way, you know, I can see that success in my students.
Excellent. Well, Jason, thank you for being on the show today. Listeners, go to letsquitteaching.com. What a cool looking website. You got a blog, a bunch of blog posts to where you share your thoughts in addition to your book. How else can they follow you or keep track of your work?
You can reach me on at Let's Quit Teaching, no G, on Twitter. Okay.
Mainly. That's Southern. And,
yeah. Well, and also, you run out of characters. The book sprang out of basically the blog that's on there. So you'll if you go back and read some, especially some older ones in the last year or so, you'll see some of the stuff we talked about tonight. But I try to keep that updated. You know, I've got some school districts reaching out now that things are kind of picking up. And so I might be visiting some school districts throughout the country, you know, talking about this thing called designing learning. And so hopefully, you know, I just want to give something to teachers and leaders that we don't have to work so hard, you know, and we're killing ourselves, you know, with all the tier two and tier three services we're providing, when if we just fix tier one, all this other stuff, you know, will heal itself.
Yeah.
You know,
I like hearing
if we just design for learning to happen at high levels with impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you, Jason.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you guys.
We're super grateful for having you on, and we look forward to following you and looking for your sequel coming out here in the next couple of years.
We will see.
As always, thank you for checking us out at The Peg Doesn't Fit. We appreciate you listening. You can find us on Twitter at The Peg Doesn't Fit. You can find me at Ryan D. Bartle 1.
And my personal Twitter is at Eric J. Steven. You can also email us at thepegdoesntfit@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at anchor.fm/thepegdoesntfit.
Drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Tell your educator friends or family, anybody. We'd love to hear from you.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week on The Peg Doesn't Fit.